Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepherd and run by me, Thomas Manuel. This is a podcast where we talk about indie role-playing games in all their forms, with people who design them, write about them, think about them, whatever. This podcast, along with the weekly indie RPG newsletter, is powered by a gem of subtle and terrifying strength. In its facets, we glimpse ourselves and our many twisting... It's Patreon. This podcast is powered by Patreon. And if you head over to patreon.com/indierpg, you can join folks like Smike, Kieran, Clark Olson-Smith, Lisa Paddle, Will Hindmuch, and many others. And you would help contribute to keeping the space going, which I would really appreciate. All right, with that out of the way, let's get to the interview. Hello, everyone. I'm sitting down with Emily Friedman. Emily is an associate professor of English at Auburn University and director of 18th Connect, a website dedicated to scholarship around the long 18th century, as we call it. Though an 18th century literary scholar and critic by training, Emily is now one of the foremost chroniclers of the phenomenon that we call actual play. She teaches games, she teaches actual play in the classroom, she regularly writes about it on sites like Polygon. In fact, as of recording this, I think we're basically at the one-year anniversary of her first piece on Polygon, which is about New York by Night, Vampire, the Masquerade actual play series. She's also working on a book titled Improvised Worlds, Digital Storytelling Through Play. Emily, I'm so glad that you're joining me here today. Did I miss anything in that bio? How are you?
I'm doing super. I know you and I are both kind of slowly coming back from jet lag from our different corners of the earth. But no, this is the most fun part of doing this particular kind of scholarship, is getting to sit down and talk to smart people and see how our perspectives align and differ. Yeah, there's a whole bunch more on the CV. The CV is like a disturbing number of pages, but most of it is. But you crystallize the important parts at this point in time.
Yeah, I'm sure. If people want to see Emily's full CV, she has a personal website, ecfriedman.com. You should go there and check it out.
Own the means of production, folks.
Yes.
Have a corner of the web that you own if you can.
Okay, Emily, so I want to, you know, start us off with kind of, I guess, the obvious question. How does a literature scholar transition to writing about actual play? Is there one specific event that triggers it? Is it a series of events? What's the story there?
Well, the sassy, overly simplified answer, right, is have a global pandemic completely ruin your decade-long project? And that's part of it. But actually, I was writing about actual play before the COVID-19 pandemic began, because my other parallel research is in never published manuscript fiction. So things that are written in English primarily between 1750 and 1900. These are things that were written by hand. And so they only exist in one copy, but we have evidence that they circulated. And so I've always been fascinated by this notion, and we can tie it to what would later be the indie scene, right? Of people who are choosing modes of production that are not mass, that are for a very specific kind of coterie or collective or imagined readership. And why would you make that decision? So the story went for most of my career that manuscript publication, so writing a bunch of handwritten copies and circulating them, dies after print technology, the superior technology, emerges. And so when I found these things in 2009 and found more and more and more of them, I realized that I was seeing the kind of birth of a project that might think about these people who are choosing differently, that are saying, I have artistic needs for expression that the print marketplace will not allow me to circulate. And so I knew I wanted that project to speak to a wider public. And so I started experimenting with writing to different fields. And so I was writing a bunch of articles on my way to what I thought was going to be this book, which the working title for it is Before Fan Fiction. And someday it will get written. I've just been waylaid for a while. And along the way, there was a call for papers about tabletop games in the digital age. And I've been watching actual play since the start of my academic career, which is when Acquisitions Incorporated is going and Critical Role is going. So I propose a thing on Critical Role and narrative time as a fun thing to write for a month. And that's how I meet Adrian Herman, who teaches that article in his class a few months after it's published. And it kind of cascaded from there. And so I've been told by colleagues that the 18th century is kind of my superpower in this field because it allows me to think differently and more capaciously about how this form, both TTRPG more broadly and actual play more specifically, fit into the history of people trying to do things differently with media.
I love that. I love that. I think one of my favorite things about talking to academics is the fact that they can bring the sense of perspective to things, right? Like nothing is new and everything has been studied, and it's nice to contextualize things, you know, as part of a long history rather than something that's completely new that's going to disappear, right?
Yeah. I often say I like my takes, not hot takes, but slow braised takes, which, you know, I do a little bit more of the kind of immediate response with Polygon. And I think that's been really useful for my writing and thinking practice. But the value that I give is that I can sit with this and sit on things. You know, not everything has to come out kind of journalistically in the ways that some of my colleagues who are covering this, you know, they have to because of the marketplace. Yeah. I have tenure. I'm one of the lucky ones. And so that's really helpful in those ways.
So were you interested in tabletop games, or were you playing them prior to discovering actual play, or was that semi-simultaneous?
So actual play came and brought me back and reminded me what tabletop could be. I played a lot of tabletop almost to the edge of bad LARP in high school. And so that's the mid to late 90s. That's the kind of dominance of White Wolf. And also, because I'm from Texas, Steve Jackson games. So behind me, like, my library includes, you know, everything from Tune to Innomine, which I went to a Catholic school. We played a lot of Innomine. Even the most hardcore Catholic in our gaming group was willing to, you know, play an angel. So, and then I went to college in a place where the kind of sci-fi and fantasy nerds were like, and this is not an exaggeration on my part, they were white nationalists, oh, wow. Right? They were eugenicists. It was really like you were drawing a line in the sand by aligning yourself with that practice. And so my satanic panic came late in the early 2000s. And then grad school got in the way. And I had friends who were playing in grad school, but I was kind of, you know, trying to read every 18th century novel I could get my hands on at the time. So having the job and being able to kind of explore things, and I have dear friends in the history department, one of whom is a lifelong dungeon master, and I overheard them talking about the new 5th edition, which I had heard about because I'd been watching the D&D Next actual plays from Acquisitions Incorporated. And I was like, why are you not inviting me? We're in the middle of this party. And like, well, we thought you were cool. We thought you wouldn't want to play. And now I'm the like junior DM taking all the good notes and bringing the good snacks. Nice. And we've been playing ever since. So yeah, and ever since then, even before I started really studying it, the so-called D&D Renaissance has really brought some interesting people who are, you know, curious, and then you can bring them into other games, of course, which is what I do at my table. So I have a very traditional every Sunday 5th edition game that I play at, and then my tables are doing all kinds of strange things. Nice. There is one all 18th century scholar group. They started out by playing D&D, and now we're playing Regency Cthulhu. Wow. So we'll see how they react to this. These are not combat folks, yeah, but they're also not normally horror folks either. So we live in interesting times. Yes,
that sounds like a lot of fun. I assume that you're kind of very used to explaining to people what actual play is and why it's worth taking seriously. And I feel like that's the first thing we kind of need to do in this conversation.
No, we got to do
it. Yeah, I mean,
the book has to do it. Every article I write for a new audience has to do it. Yeah, so actual play is a large umbrella term. And of course, it has older connections to literal actual play, so recordings of play sessions for the purposes of design feedback and these sorts of things. And so that tradition combines with a kind of improvised play that was also kind of coming into being and thriving offline in the 1990s. And then once you get the platforms that allow for video, Twitch and YouTube, and before that, things like Vine, you suddenly have the ability to have a wider audience beyond kind of the convention circuit and things like that. So generally speaking, actual play as we know it now kind of is about 15-ish years old in its digital form. It is most commonly associated with Dungeons and Dragons because the very biggest games play that. But there's also a significant, what I call the ambitious middle, who often differentiate themselves by either being an anthology series that play many different games or, you know, play one game that they think works particularly well for their method of storytelling. So it is a big umbrella term that is quickly needing subterms, but we are still, of course, at the early stages of saying, can we all just call it actual play? Like, no, I know you want to call it narrative play, Taylor Moore of Fortunate Horse, who edits Worlds Beyond Number, among other things. But we're not there yet. Can we just have one term and then subterms, please and thank you? But yeah, so it's narratologically speaking, we talk about narrative levels. Jen Gruling has written about this. Other folks have written about this, where when we are at a table together, there's the narrative level of the dungeon master constructing the world. There's players who are narrating their actions. There are players speaking in character. There's the narrative level of the mechanics of the dice. What actual play adds on top of all of that is a spectator who is not a player participant. One or more.
Yeah. And, you know, at the highest level, a lot more.
a lot more. Most recently, the channel Smosh on YouTube, which has 7 million followers, has dipped into D&D and got 500,000 views in the first day.
Yeah.
Running a very bare bones, no fancy anything aside from multiple cameras focused on a real table.
Yeah. It feels like if you're a sort of internet performer of any kind, if you're a content creator of any kind with a large audience, like you could make actual play right now and like specifically D&D actual play and attract an audience. It feels like a truth that's kind of circulating in the sort of like media world right now, right? Like that this is something you could be doing.
Yeah, and we can see kind of over time, to the extent that we have good data about the number of shows that are coming onto the scene. Obviously, there's a boom at the start of 5th edition. And then when Critical Role comes on, there's another boom of ambitious shows in its wake. And in 2018, in particular, when Critical Role becomes its own independent company, 2020, the pandemic means everybody has improved kind of audiovisual in many cases and more free time, or at least time stuck at home. So you see a huge boom then. It's somewhat reduced since, but if any time of day we can get on, say, Twitch, and there's at least 70 actual play shows, give or take, in dozens of languages, and of course depending on the time zone, right? Yeah. It's which languages are being represented is then the question. But yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is that it is a super saturated in many ways kind of space, depending on what you're trying to do and what kind of audience you're trying to capture. If you're trying to capture the same TTRPG people, we know from survey data that I have collected of respondents of people who both make actual play, but also people who watch actual play and also people who don't watch actual play at all. And we know that, you know, the number of hours a week kind of maxes out for the majority of people at no more than 10. That's not a whole lot of shows to be keeping track with given the length of actual play. So there's only so much time that people have to consume these things, unless you're me and you make it my job. And so it really becomes its actual play is often compared to regional theater, like community theater, right? But community theater can thrive in hundreds and thousands of different places because you have to go to, say, my town of Auburn, Alabama, or maybe the few towns over, and you've got a little group of 100 people, 200 people. Meanwhile, the new restriction is time zones, right? That, and even that with pre-recorded material, asynchronous material, is flattened. So, and most shows are not live. A lot of shows have moved to pre-recorded. And so liveness is not as important to many shows. And so that becomes the new challenge of, okay, so are you going to localize in other kinds of ways to a particular kind of audience and a particular kind of storytelling? Or are you going to keep going after the kind of audience that has been captured by any number of shows already?
I assume with any kind of saturated media, there's a lot of targeted differentiation that you kind of need to do at an early stage. But I also assume that the probably numerically the large majority of people doing actual play are, for lack of a better term, hobbyists, you know, people who enjoy performance and want to perform and, you know, are doing it as a platform for that, or just recording their home games. Is that assumption accurate, or am I off?
Well, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that most, for functionally no one in this space, with the exception of fewer than a dozen people, and this includes the cast of Critical Role when I say this, or Dimension 20, these big names that we're familiar with. This is no one's only job. So there is a group that is, for whom this is part of a portfolio of creative labor. They are professionals in theater, in film and television, or in other kind of web media. And this is a creative form of expression that may be an additional income stream or allows them creative freedom that they don't have in other parts of their job, or both, ideally. Very few of them are being paid, even in terms of profit sharing. For most of the ambitious middle, the current success is to be sustainable, which is to say that they have the resources that allow them to continue to create. For the luckier ones, this also includes sustainability in terms of being able to pay themselves, or at least some portion of them, a kind of living wage for the labor that they're doing. But it's also alongside other kinds of work. And then, but then you do also have, you know, an enormous base of what we might call hobbyists. I mean, I think hobby is really hard to talk about. Intentionality is really hard to talk about. I did this kind of mega survey that has about 4,500 respondents, which is, for those not familiar with academic surveys, that's a really big yield. And we can talk about how that happened and how I had to explain it to my colleagues, which meant I had to explain who Matthew Mercer was. But I'm hoping to follow it up with qualitative interviews, and I have a research protocol for that to kind of talk to creators more in depth about how they're defining industry versus field versus space versus community, why they do what they do, and try to speak to as many people from different kinds of positionalities, be it, you know, where are they literally, as well as, we know that creators kind of span a bunch of different ages. Mm. We know that creators and audiences are pretty equally divided across the generations and across genders. The biggest is millennials and Generation Z, and those are equally NB, masculine identified and female identified. So, but yeah, the kind of the whys and the wherefores are fascinating. And we get a hint of this, right, when we look at Twitter or social media and we watch people kind of selling. I mean, I get a lot of emails now of people pitching their actual plays to me. And I see what I keep saying, the ambitious middle. Those are also the most likely folks to submit their work to webfests. Mm. And seek that kind of validation for their work and increased visibility, because discoverability is terrible. Even before social media went kaput, it's very hard to find these things on Twitch and YouTube, because most live actual plays are playing to, if you've got more people in your Twitch chat than you have on screen, you're doing better than the vast majority of actual plays. So these are hard things, but it depends on what you're there for. And it's, for some people, yeah, they're putting their home game online very, very explicitly. But there's a big group of folks who are trying to do something more than that as a kind of creative expression.
And I think that the thing that kind of complicates that, I mean, from my point of view at least, is that actual play is actually work, right?
There's a great book called Not Getting Paid to Do What You Love. And it is about influencers in the beauty and fashion industry. But what's really interesting, right, is Duffy in that book articulates that everybody who's doing this, whether they're making money or not, whether they're big or small, it's all labor. It's labor for different kinds of reasons. Some of it is with a kind of idea for professionalization in this space. Others, it's, I have a job and this is the fun. This is the fun labor. But what she's very insistent on is saying, the one thing we can't do is say that these are deluded people who are acting irrationally. The world is literally on fire, right? Yeah. Both your region and mine are seeing record heat waves, the likes of which we have never seen. The coast of my hometown is throwing up dead fish from the Gulf of Mexico. So in such a world, if you're going to labor, you know, part of putting aside some of your labor time to something that you see of as a creative expression in and of itself. Because I think that my suspicion is that, like these influencers that Duffy spoke to almost, you know, half a decade ago, so too, I think more TTRPG folks than we usually think are aware that, like, there's not a whole lot of money, or we're passing the same $5 around, but that there's a meaning in making. Do I think that they should be compensated for their labor and we should, you know, have something like universal basic income? Absolutely. But these are, you know, rational actors making kind of value-driven choices that are antithetical to the market. It's funny, you know, we're recording this right after I'm coming off of an actual play recording, which is hilarious because I do it as kind of field work more than like, this is the exciting thing. Like, I'm very nervous doing it. It's not where my joy is. When I went to performing arts schools as a child, but I was the one dressed all in black, like moving set pieces around or running lights. I love playing when the recording is not on the line, but somehow my job, my research has led me to these spaces where I can observe and it requires me to do this. And I'm like, ah.
Okay, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of the form of actual play. When mm-hmm. I say it, and I imagine what listeners are also picturing in their heads right now, is either like a video stream where people are playing together in the same room, or we're seeing kind of like all their cameras streaming from webcams or things like that, or podcasts mm-hmm. like Party of One, all not going to miss a chance to say...
Hey.
Just a shout out, Jeff Strom was amazing.
We love you, Jeff. You're the best.
So
gonna make you listen to this episode so that you know.
I know you have a bunch of examples of actual play that maybe don't fit this picture. So what are those, and can you explain to my audience, like, you know, what they're trying to do and why they're interesting?
Yeah. So I mean, I think you're right that there are basically two extremely common versions. We can kind of divide actual play in a couple of different ways. One is it born audio? Audio is always the only form that the final product is imagined in, versus a kind of video, usually with a podcast that also kind of comes following it. And then a further kind of division that is true to both of them is, are you recording using video conferencing software like the kinds that we're using right now to have a conversation, or are you doing it in a studio? If you're doing it in a studio, then it becomes, how many cameras do you have, and how many people are visible to the viewer at any given time? So in the kind of format popularized by Critical Role, we know you're seeing everybody. It's everyone, everywhere, all at once. But yeah, and that's enormously taxing on performers, but it's enormously pleasurable for that audience who has taken to kind of clipping and other practices of kind of recirculation of very small parts, so much so that Critical Role has a very specific intellectual property rule set that encourages that practice for its long form content. So you can go and see, like, do you like this one character because you saw their art? You don't have to watch an episode of Critical Role. You can go on YouTube and watch the 4-hour supercut of all of the kind of emotional beats this character goes through or you can watch the animated version or that, both the kind of animated recap and then the full-fledged Legends of Vox Machina. There are some experiments with trying to break free of a table. Kolok by Hyper RPG is kind of the classic example in both their Kolok 1991 and their Kolok most recent season. They basically film LARPs with multiple cameras moving around. In Kolok 1991, it is a city council meeting that starts out very dry and banal, and then the horrible things that we know as the audience, because we've been watching all of the events that lead up to this. This is a game run on kids on bikes, usually, that come into the room, right? And it's a who's who of Los Angeles Day players in the tabletop space who have been given very minimal directions. And the driver is moving around when there's a role to be made, kind of adjudicating those kinds of very, very streamlined mechanics in order to make that happen. And then they do it with big fancy virtual sets in the Council of the Gods episode that they did most recently. But yeah, so there's a lot of experimentation in the space in terms of narrative time, in terms of what players do and don't know. My favorite example of players who are able to use the medium to transform meaning is Dungeons and Daddies, which is the most successful podcast that is supported by Patreon. And they, in their first season, propose a solution to a problem that involves time travel, and they propose it to the DM, and the DM calls for a role, allows it, and then they pull out the podcast, you know, RSS feed, have him go to the second episode where they travel back in time, and the players have already re-recorded and re-uploaded to the stream.
Which is so amazing. Which is such a funny and clever thing to do.
It's remarkably clever, especially since they use the fact that they have this huge back catalog of the DM's utterances to be able to insert him authorizing it into that second episode. And it's fascinating because depending on when you listened to this podcast, your second episode experience is of this completely random, like, time travel event that comes out of nowhere and is never addressed again for 62 episodes, which is fabulous. I mean, they're clever in all kinds of ways, but that's what's lovely and what I live for in this form is when the play extends to what is being displayed, right? Because actual play, like turning on your cameras and recording play session, is a thing, and it has certain kinds of uses. But audience-aware actual play, for me, is where the transformation into something different becomes very, very interesting, and not just, you know, a cheap imitation, but instead it's Pokemon level up. There's a transubstantiation that's happening where now we as audience matter. Kolok is a good example of that too, because they have this whole parallel game where it does not impact, generally speaking, the events. It's not a kind of you pay your money and always are, you know, changing the outcome of something. But you're playing a game with the audience, and maybe your character gets plucked out and becomes an NPC. Maybe they never do, but it's parallel play in an interesting kind of way. And I think there's more experimentation to come, I hope, with that kind of thinking about what can this form do that just recording us playing can't do. And not just in terms of like making the lighting cues better or that sort of thing, but instead really playing with what does it mean to use mechanics to tell a story.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point about how actual play, because of what's successful in terms of streams, also has some kind of genre baked in, right? Very often they're either comedies, you know, very out and out kind of goofy comedies. Mm-hmm. It is usually like a vehicle for like comedy improvisation. And then there's the kind of slow burn, multi-hour kind of drama.
What's striking to me, and this has been very recent, like the last couple of days, thinking through like what genres are working and not working, and which genres are we seeing at the kind of most watched and listened to forms, which is not to say that there are not people who are doing these genres, but they are not, they do not have the kind of market share. I hate that word, but you know what I mean. And that's romance. You know, there's so many, you know, games, you know, Passionis and Emily Carabas's romance trilogy and Monster Hearts, although Monster Hearts gets a fair amount of play, but, you know, that require a delicate hand. And the Girls Run These Worlds has done a fair amount of this. Good Society gets a lot of play, I think, because it is a romance that doesn't require physicality because of the Regency-ness of it all.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's interesting to me that while romance and sex have featured and been referenced in these kinds of big blockbuster, so to speak, or relatively speaking, actual plays, Critical Role tried Monster Hearts. I think the general audience consensus was it didn't go especially well. And that's, you know, any number of completely understandable reasons. But I'm very curious, because you would think that in a deeply parasocial form that has been often compared to pornography, that romance performance would be precisely the kind of thing that people would want to watch and want to do. And I don't think that's actually true. Although, what's interesting to me, like I put out, because, you know, we're all on like 5 million platforms right now during this, the death of Twitter. But so I, as a kind of A-B testing, I asked on Mastodon and Blue Sky and Twitter, like, hey, if you perform actual play, what game do you really love to play that you would never play on stream? And if you are an audience member, what would you never want to watch other people play? And I was surprised. I was expecting, you know, this is what happens, right? This is why you ask the question, because you're going to be wrong in an interesting way. And I thought a lot of people would talk about erotic games, and they didn't. They talked about crunchy games. They talked about games that were too complex for actual play, or that they didn't want to get into, like Pendragon is too long, you know, you'd have to edit the hell out of, you know, Shadowrun, or you get the idea. There were a couple of people who said Bluebeard's Bride, which is interesting because there's an actual play of Bluebeard's Bride that's doing the festival circuit at the moment. But a lot of people were like, oh, that's too intimate. But that was a very small number of people mentioning, like, something is too emotionally intimate for me to either watch or perform on stream. And I still don't know whether that's an unawareness of that genre of game, which is possible, or whether it's people have very different boundaries than I do. Both can be true.
Yeah.
More data needed. But yeah, the other thing that I was noting recently in these kinds of, like, what are the limitations, what are the constraints, is that at the highest levels, the things that are most, like, you want to have a long-term company with a kind of successful brand, is you don't want to have player versus player antagonism. Mm. So I was asking around for examples of long-term campaigns where the main party, not a guest, not a limited appearance, found themselves in irreconcilable conflict for a significant amount of time, and the power of friendship did not fix it. And of course, like, who does this the best? I mean, the answer is almost always Friends at the Table, because they are constantly switching between systems and they're willing to kind of go to those kinds of places in interesting kinds of ways. So they've done that kind of conflict so many times that, like, my mentions were pinging with multiple different seasons where people were highlighting, that ended in bloodshed. But if you compare it to the other really well-known kind of shows, when there's conflict, it's very limited. Mm. It's resolved. It cannot sustain itself. Even when, you know, the famous example is Brennan Lee Mulligan in A Crown of Candy. He wants Game of Thrones. And so, but as a safety tool, he goes to the players before they film and he says, okay, so here's the deal. We're doing a vote and it's one veto means we don't have PvP. And someone vetoed, and so this season did not have PvP violence in a Game of Thrones season, right? So the antagonism had to come from somewhere else. I've talked to folks since who are like, yeah, this would be terrible for branding. And there are people who are thinking about that. You know, that is not like a critical role Dimension 20 kind of thing. That is all the way down people thinking about, you know, what does it mean if people don't like me because my character makes particular kinds of choices? Oh, wow. Or what does it mean if people are having to pick sides in a show? That doesn't mean that people aren't trying this and doing really interesting and ambitious things with it, but there's definitely the sense of, oh, that's an extremely risky thing to do, which I find, unless and this, we do come back to mechanics, unless the system has basically built into the contract that the audience understands. Like Vampire Game, absolutely, right? You know you're going to have conflict. And in fact, New York by Night is built to facilitate that kind of conflict in a really interesting way, because the first season was one coterie, the second season was an adversarial coterie. These coteries are now breaking apart because of their own internal tensions, but they can reconstitute into new alliances for the third season. So you can get these kinds of shifting alliances in a way that doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to freak out. But yeah, you can do that in a Vampire Game. You can do that, you know, if you're playing Paranoia and you don't think that there's going to be, that kind of... But yeah, no, D&D is, we talk so much about D&D as a power fantasy, but the found family trope is so incredibly important to that, to the prevalence of that form.
Agreed. Just looking at the time here, I would love to get into the standard questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Yeah. My first question is in a section called Infectious Enthusiasm. I ask, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with and want to recommend to my listeners?
I don't know if this makes me basic or not, but I don't care. I adore The Quiet Year. Wow. I teach it in my classes. I ran it most recently for my nephew who is 8. So a classroom full of 8 and 9-year-olds. Ooh. And I had, you know, you cut the deck so it's shorter. I removed some of the cards that had kind of what I thought were either vocabulary words that I didn't necessarily want to get into, too complex, or concepts that I thought were a little too dark. And then of course they're 8 and 9-year-olds. They bring their own darkness to the table, right? You know, homicidal ducks and all kinds of things. It was an amazing experience, and it's such a lovely game to play with that kind of player, because, you know, 8 and 9-year-olds, everybody wants to talk right now. And The Quiet Year makes you wait. But you have a mechanism for interacting even when it's not your turn, because you can take contempt tokens. And the tiny skulls that come with the print version of this game are just comedy gold. It was hilarious. So yeah, I love that game. I wish there was a comparable physicality to the Deep Forest, which is the kind of flipped post-colonial version. And I keep thinking about what is the visual distinction that would need to be made for the Deep Forest. But yeah, love The Quiet Year.
Okay, so in my next question, which is the section titled Tyranny of Numbers, I ask, what's a number that you can share from your work?
Well, I'll keep on. I have so many statistics in front of me because I pulled the survey data, and I'll say that I'll give a good one and a bleak one. And so we know that most people who listen or watch actual plays, the majority watch fewer than 4 a week or a month. Okay. So, you know, when you're trying to capture the extant audience, they can only be loyal to so many shows at a time. What's really lovely about the data that I've collected is while Dungeons and Dragons is still by and large the biggest kind of chunk of the pie, there is a significant numbers of Forged in the Dark games, Kids on Bikes and Brooms, Monsters of the Week, Pathfinder, and Call of Cthulhu games, including, you know, Call of Cthulhu is getting an enormous amount of support from Chaosium in terms of really ambitious, full set, full costume, kind of actual play productions. Nice. And there are literally dozens of systems that are reflected in the data of people reporting, you know, what systems are they paying attention to when they're when they're watching and listening, which I think is a good thing.
In the section, all advice is advice for myself, I ask, what's a habit or technique you're trying to get better at your table?
I think a lot of what I'm trying to do right now, and this is pedagogical practice as well as player practice, is listen. You would think, having gone to a Quaker college, that I would be better at holding in the silence, but I am not, I confess. But every time I have interviewed people who are responsible for casting actual plays at the kind of quote-unquote highest levels, and I ask them what makes a good player, what they're looking for is not flashy performance. What they're looking for is who's listening to the other people when it's not their scene and reacting and being the good first audience. Wow. So a lot of what I'm trying to kind of cultivate in my own practice is being the good first audience for my students, for my interview subjects, for my colleagues and collaborators, because that's how I can serve them best.
Wow, that is great advice for everybody. Thank you so much, Emily. Is there a place you'd like to point people at to where they can find you?
Sure. Platforms are shaky at the moment, I know, but I own and have owned for over half my life, God help me, the website EC Friedman, that's friedman.com. And I am F-R-I-E-D-E, or the German word for peace, the first part of my surname, just about everywhere on the internet, except for YouTube, where when I am teaching tabletop and actual play in the classroom, because I teach in a decentered classroom, I record 15 to 20 minute reflections on what we did. My students don't watch them, although it's designed for them, but many of my colleagues who are thinking about teaching tabletop games or just want to know what scholarship is like, that's there for them, as well as kind of conference presentations and things like that, including virtual JaneCon, which has been where my colleague Emily Kugler and I have kind of used games of all kinds to kind of spread as a kind of way to lure in Jane Austen nerds, not just Good Society, but lots of other video and tabletop games. So Critical Prof is the YouTube handle. Nice.
Yeah, I just subscribed to it today, actually. It seemed really cool. I can't wait to watch those videos.
It's so janky. it's so put together with iMovie and Spit and Tape. But, you know, Evan Torner and I are working on a longer term project to create free to access materials for the teaching of tabletop and actual play, kind of short explainer videos, since so much of the space has a lot of content that's designed for, you know, how to play the game or how to get started. We want to kind of add in quick explanations for concepts like bleed. What is a tabletop role-playing game to the extent that we can describe it in 10 minutes, those kinds of things. And with the help of production teams affiliated with my university, we may just make this into something that is less, you know, homemade and more exciting and dynamic.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Emily. Thanks for chatting. I really appreciate your time and, you know, your expertise on this subject.
My deep pleasure.